Good morning. Welcome to Back Chat. I'm Danny Gittings. Your co-host this morning is Jim Gould. Good morning, Jim.
Morning, Danny.
In this morning's show, a week on from Britain's shock decision to exit the European Union, we'll be reflecting on the lessons from last Thursday's Brexit vote. What implications may it have for Hong Kong and other parts of the world? It was fears of the effects of mass immigration, far more than any other issue, which pushed a narrow majority of British voters into rejecting continued membership of the European Union. Many see strong parallels between the Brexit vote and Donald Trump's populist campaign for the American presidency, which has also sought to stoke fears about the effects of mass immigration. Some have even suggested we can draw a parallel with the rise of localist groups in Hong Kong, who've often sought to blame mainland visitors for all manners of social ills. So what do you think? Is the world entering a new era of xenophobia in which countries from Britain to the United States, and perhaps even Hong Kong, turn their back on the free movement of people, and perhaps even turn their back on globalization as a whole? How much damage could this do to the global economy? Could it trigger another global recession? Or is Brexit simply a special case driven by domestic political forces in Britain, and unlikely to have any wider implications? Email us with your thoughts. Our email address, backchat@rthk.hk. That's backchat@rthk.hk. You can go to our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio Free, and leave a comment there. Or give us a call, the number 233-88-266. That's 233-88-266. Joining us for the main segment of the discussion, we have in our Queensway studio, David Webb, who's shareholder, activist and founder of website.com. Here with us in Broadcasting House, Sean Stars, who's assistant professor, Department of Asian and International Studies at City University of Hong Kong. We also have on the phone, George Corfoli, who's the vice chair of the Hong Kong Democratic Foundation. And joining us from Spain, Professor Gonzalo Villata-Praig, who is a professor at the Faculty of Law at the Chinese University of Hong Kong here. Yeah. Professor Villata-Praig, let's go to you first. Thank you for joining us. It must be pretty late at night over there. What's the mood where you are at the moment? We've been seeing statements from Spanish officials that they don't want any special favours for Britain, and particularly separate treatment for Scotland. And it seems like they want to take a hard line to avoid Brexit encouraging perhaps other countries to leave the EU.
Good morning. Yes, you are right. The mood, I suppose, for a start, is one of sadness. There is a very real sense of sadness, both in Spain and in the rest of continental Europe. The feeling is as if a very dear family member has left. And that departure obviously has it carries with it a very great sense of sadness and drama. Now, beyond the sadness, there is also the political reality. And in Spain specifically, there is a sense that the process now with the UK should be a moderate one. It should be a careful, progressive discussion, a negotiation. And the point here is one about Scotland, the fear that Scotland may proceed through to independence, and the implications that an eventual Scottish independence would have on the Spanish national project, specifically in relation to Catalonia. If Scotland were to become independent, then that could obviously trigger a separatist movement in Catalonia. So Spain is very wary about that possibility, and it is desperate to ensure that the exit process is a gradual one, one that does not allow for that Scottish independence eventuality.
But is it accepted as a done deal, Professor Villata-Praig? Because, I mean, for instance, you could look at the UK result and you could argue that, well, only 37% of registered electors actually voted to leave the European Union. Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty still has to be activated in order for the UK to begin the process of leaving. The current Prime Minister, David Cameron, he's going to step down later this year, but he's not going to do it. He's going to leave that to his successor. I mean, is there a feeling that we haven't heard the end of the story here?
Yes and no. I think that the feeling is one of inevitability, in that in a democratic environment, a referendum is a very strong mandate, and so the political leadership is reluctant to ignore it. So on the one hand, you do have the democratic pressure to respect the wish of the majority, however small that majority may have been. On the other hand, there is, I suppose, a hope, a very vague hope, that in the end, the United Kingdom will see sense, and that the new Prime Minister may not want to continue with the process and trigger the Article 50 mechanism. But it is more of a hope than a reality. I think that the reality, both in the United Kingdom and in the rest of Europe, is that the referendum was a strong enough mandate, and that sooner or later, Brexit will become inevitable.
Okay, we're discussing the implications of the British referendum decision for Britain to exit the European Union, the implications for Europe and beyond for the rest of the world as well. If you have any thoughts, email us at backchat@rthk.hk. That's backchat@rthk.hk. You can go to our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio 3, and leave a comment there. You just heard Professor Gonzalo Villar-Tepuig from the Faculty of Law at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. Let's bring in David Webb now. David Webb, shareholder activist and founder of website.com. And am I right in thinking also not a fan of the European Union?
Yes.
That would be right. That was a supposition based on one or two things you posted on your website. So you think this is great news, presumably, and Britain is better off outside the European Union.
I left the UK 25 years ago, so I did not have a vote, and that's quite right. I don't pay taxes there. But if I did have a vote, I would have voted on balance to leave. And the reasons are, in my view, more about the devolution of power, economic independence, and unfortunately the failed European project. I think it started out with good intents to be a common market, promoting free trade in the 1970s, in an era when there wasn't a lot of free trade and a lot of countries still had capital controls and so on. And it morphed into a failed European superstate in an attempt to produce a European constitution at one stage and to bring centralise more and more power in unelected, or at least not directly elected, bodies.
So as someone who would have voted for Brexit if you'd had a vote, how do you feel when people compare the Brexiteers to the people voting for Donald Trump in the US and for perhaps some of the more extreme localist groups here, and say this is about an angry sentiment that's not always driven by rational thinking? And
I think there's quite a lot of rational thinking that went into a lot of people's votes. There is a tension between free trade and immigration, and but it doesn't mean that just because you believe in free trade, you have to open your borders to unlimited movement of people. If America did that, for example, it has a free trade agreement with Canada and Mexico, the two countries that have land borders, very extensive ones, but it doesn't have a free movement in people. If it did, then you do have to worry about the impact on low-skilled labour and the price of low-skilled labour, and the welfare obligations that go with subventing that if you have unlimited migration. But on the other hand, if you obviously talk to farmers in the UK, they would probably say, well, you know, our strawberry pickers all come from impoverished countries in the European Union that have recently joined, and we're going to have to pay a lot more if we can't recruit them in future, or if we even have to deport those that are leaving. There has been a clear indication from the Leave camp that they're not trying to deport the 2 million European Union citizens who are already working in the UK, but at some point there's probably going to be some sort of cut-off at which the threshold for entry rises. And in a way, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because it would result in a more consistent approach in the UK to migration from all over the world. They already have criteria for non-EU citizens, and they've been favouring EU citizens instead. And now they'll have to take a consistent approach to the skill sets that they need and decide how much low-skilled labour they're willing to admit at the expense of depressing wages for low-skilled British people.
If we could just bring in George Cawthorley now, because I believe you can only be with us until 9 o'clock. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Yeah. Could I ask you about the argument that this is a somewhat... George Cawthorley, you're a vice chairman of the Hong Kong Democratic Foundation.
Former
vice chairman. How about the argument that this vote in the UK was something of a flawed democratic exercise? The threshold for winning it was set too low. It has no legal force, and decisions such as this in the United Kingdom are made by Parliament and not by referenda.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I generally agree with all that. Like David, I'm an absentee Brit. I've been living in Hong Kong for the last 51 years. This is where I was born. But I still have a great concern about the UK. I think referendums on something of this magnitude should not be decided by a simple majority. I think the same went for the Scottish referendum. I think there should be both a vote-level requirement and a pass mark. People are talking about 60%, 75% voting. I think that would have made things, of course, a lot more difficult for the Brexiteers to win, and probably impossible. But what you're left with is you're left with a divided nation, half are satisfied and half are dissatisfied. And I think also what is impinged upon the whole thing is that the Leave campaign ran a campaign of lies and innuendo, and of course there was that famous £350 million pounds a week that we could put back into the national NHS. Health. And I mean, since that was emblazoned on a bus, I hope someone is going to take the Leave campaign to court.
Both sides on exaggerated their cases. I think you've got to admit.
Well, I agree. I agree with you, David. And I think the Remain campaign has to be blamed for running a totally negative campaign without highlighting the benefits of being a member of the EU, and I was originally very pro-economic union, the EU, more sceptical about closer political involvement, but since we have it, I think Britain had a role, and they've been very ambivalent about their role in Europe, had a role of fashioning a political union that was not so intense, but I think basically they've abdicated their responsibilities over Europe. If I'd had a vote, I would have still voted for Remain, because I think geopolitically there are good reasons to be part of, you know, you've got the USA, you've got China, and you've got Europe. And if you just detach yourself from Europe, you then have no world influence at all.
Well, I don't think that's true at all. You have only a marginal influence in Europe when you've only got something like 3% of the votes in the EU.
David, that's not correct. You have
qualified influence. Majority voting since the Treaty of Lisbon.
Yes, but you can influence people to vote the way you think, and I think that's where Britain has failed miserably. It's not played that role.
Well, they can still influence whether they're in or out.
When you're out, you don't influence.
You will have a lot of influence on something more important, which is probably the World Trade Organization's deadlocked talks on liberalising free trade generally. Because if the whole world had moved to free trade, would the European Union really matter? There's an element of fortress Europe involving the EU, where they, if you're in, you get to trade freely amongst the bloc, but then they erect barriers. They have this ridiculous common agricultural policy where they collect money from all member states and disperse it to farmers at the rate of about 50 billion euros per year, which is still about 40% of their budget. And they make it very hard for developing nations to bootstrap themselves with agricultural output when they are subsidizing European farmers and flooding the world with their excess lakes of milk and cereals and so on, mountains of cereals. So there are certain aspects of the EU which are not pro-trade at all. They are fortress Europe.
Okay, let's bring in Sean Stars at this moment, Assistant Professor in the Department of Asian and International Studies at Hong Kong City University. Sean, what lessons do you see for this part of the world? What parallels with the vote that happened in the United Kingdom?
I think it's a bit more complicated. I think there's a generational divide, and so I don't think we can say that, you know, 51%, for example, of the British people want to leave the UK. So of the 18 to 24-year-olds, 73% voted to remain. And, you know, their turnout was only 36%. So you mentioned that the overall share of the electorate was only 37%, but the youth turnout was very low, whereas for those over 55, so between 55 and 64-year-old, 81% turned out. Those over 65, 83% turned out. So I think there are some common...
But it's easy to criticise the electoral process, but it was a fair one. In fact, the deadlines for registering were extended. It may be that young people were too indecisive or not sure about their vote and decided not to vote, which maybe is a responsible course of action. But at the end of the day, it was 52 to 48. I think one of your... Jim suggested that perhaps there should have been a supermajority, Jim Gould, but why exactly? Should there have been a supermajority to join the EU in the first place? It was a binary referendum. I think 50% is the right threshold for a decision like that. And if it had been posed the other way, should we stay in rather than should we leave, it would also have been a 50% criterion. And, you can analyse the turnouts till the cows come home, but no one has suggested that the vote was rigged in any way, that there was ballot rigging or stuffing or anything like that. Everyone had their chance, and 33 million people did vote.
Okay, well, leaving that aside for the moment, I think Sean was talking about the difference in turnout between the young and the older people.
Right.
What's the reason for that, do you think?
Right, so the those over 55, you know, were worried about their National Health Service and their pensions and so on. And Nigel Farage, as was already mentioned, you know, blazing that famous, we're paying £350 million to the EU. Let's fund our NHS instead. And then the youth they grew up in Europe, right? So, I mean, those over 55, they saw the dying days of the British Empire, and perhaps quite a few are still nostalgic for those days.
Is there a global trend here? There was an article in the South China Morning Post referred to this sort of almost talked about the selfish older generation, the aged, greedily amassed selfish privileges with no concern for the coming generation. Very strong language used there. Is Brexit an example of that?
I do see this as a global trend. So if we take it back to the U.S., for example, so many of the young, of course, overwhelmingly supported Bernie Sanders. The older, folks support Donald Trump, and for some of the similar reasons, right? It's a rejection against political and economic elites that they feel that globalization has destroyed their manufacturing jobs and so on.
How about here in Hong Kong? I mean, it was overwhelmingly the young in the umbrella protests and supporting these localist movements. You're saying we're seeing some sort of emergence of a generational... I mean, you always have some degree of generational divide, but far more than previously.
Absolutely, especially because of the rise of globalization over the past 30, 35 years or so has really moved low-paying manufacturing jobs to run across the border to China. And so a lot of the young feel that they have no hope, they have no jobs. I mean, a lot of my students, they know they're probably never going to buy a flat in Hong Kong, for example. And, this is a common feeling that their parents benefited from the rise of the welfare state, post-war, World War II rise of the welfare state, and that's now being dismantled in a lot of countries. And so the young are revolting. And, of course, the old are revolting, too, because, like I said, the welfare state is being attacked.
Professor Vilatopoig, are you still there?
Yes.
Do you see that in Spain where you are, this sort of generational divide stretching beyond just Britain?
Well, there is always a generational divide. I am not a sociologist, and I would be wrong to comment about the implications of that sociological shift. But clearly, there is a sociological divide, and we should be aware of it. The political classes should be aware of it. There is a certain sense of populism throughout the Western world. There is a certain sense of dissatisfaction as well. And as the other speakers mentioned, there is that sense that the old generation has a certain vision of the world, and the younger generation has a very different vision of the world.
Okay, we're discussing the implications of the British referendum vote with our guests here. If you have any thoughts, do email us at backchat@rthk.hk. That's backchat@rthk.hk. Or you go to our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio Free, and comment there. Let me try and bring in a selection of comments from our listeners. Henry, in a very long email, excuse me if I edit it, you can see the full version on Backchat on RTHK Radio Free, says, "The Brexit result shows each country must find ways to grow its economy fast. The voting result of Midland, which has a glorious past, but does not prosper as much as London now, is a clear example. People should ask why Germany is doing better than many others in the EU. The anti-immigrant issue reflects a lack of competitiveness of UK people relative to immigrants. It's due to their attitude, not willing to work long hours, not willing to do work which immigrants are happy to take up, and an inner unfavourable attitude to foreigners. Many do not have an international outlook. Globalisation will still continue based on commercial considerations, though political risk must be considered now as well. The UK now carries new political risks, and thus companies start considering moving to other countries. The voting result tells us that referendum is not a trustworthy nor predictable mechanism. Referendum carries a subtle shifting of responsibility to the people and not on the members of Parliament. The Brexit regret we saw tells that many vote irresponsibly or treat it as a game. It tells us that direct democracy via referendum is not as good as representative democracy via members of Parliament. Whether members of Parliament would appeal to rationalism instead of populism remains to be seen. Brexit should now be a standard case study for aspiring politicians. TC, a strong posting on Facebook, says, I reject simply equating supporting Brexit with anti-immigration or even xenophobia. Does wanting control over who and how many can enter your country constitute xenophobia? Does feeling uncomfortable with Turkey wanting to join the European Union because of its human rights record, as well as the fact that most of Turkish territories in Europe, constitute discrimination? I dislike name-calling, such as racist, fascist, xenophobes, terms which often silence very controversial yet legitimate debates. I don't believe Britain is rejecting globalisation. The British built an empire by interacting with the world. Many people who voted for Brexit simply agree that the European Union is a dysfunctional organisation in which their own country can do nothing to remedy the problem because France and Germany dominate the European Union. Furthermore, the Brexit referendum offered a very basic lesson on democracy. Get out and vote. Older voters who supported Brexit in general had a much bigger turnout than younger voters who supported staying in the European Union. Younger voters should have made a more concerted effort to cast their ballots, especially when the Leave side won by only 3.8%, instead of complaining about it online afterwards. And Tom in an email says, the true test of whether the European Union will survive or not comes in the form of the French presidential elections next year. If Marine Le Pen wins, it will be au revoir to the whole European Union project. I have lived in the UK for over 20 years, and how sad to learn that there are more people in the UK in this referendum they think like Tommy Mayer rather than the wonderful late Joe Cox, that's a reference to the Member of Parliament who was killed during the campaign. God help us all with Boris and Donald potentially can control more than 50% of nuclear weapons on this planet, and Putin and Xi holding most of the rest. Amen. A very pessimistic note from Tom there. George Coffley, because you have to go in a few minutes.
Yep.
What do you think of some of those comments you heard and also our discussion earlier about the generational divide?
Well, I think the generational divide is a big issue, but also I think it was an educational issue. I think those who were less well-educated, which tended to be the elderly, because the elderly didn't go to university to the extent that young people do today, I think they were much more susceptible to the Leave arguments, whereas the better educated took a much more, from my point of view, a rational view. I think also.
So, what are you saying here? Democracy is only for the uneducated, or something like that?
No. I'm just saying that. But if you run a campaign of lies and innuendo, you are going to appeal much more to the less well-educated, because they it's easier for them to absorb that. They don't go against it. Whereas the better educated will dissect those arguments and see what are true and what are not true.
It just sounds like you're agreeing with one of our listeners who was saying referendum are not really a very good idea.
Totally,
do you think that democracy is also not a good idea because people make stupid choices in politicians as well? They elect bad leaders, don't they, George?
Of course, they do elect bad leaders. They elect bad leaders far too often.
I know one might argue they're about to do that in the United States. So do you think we should abolish democracy because that would be better?
No, I don't think we should abolish democracy.
That's what Xi Jinping wants.
Only degree holders should have a vote, perhaps?
No.
Okay, let's let George Coffley respond.
Certainly not, because I'm not a degree holder, so I don't want to. I think that referendum is simply because it distills things into too much simplicity, and the whole EU issue is a much more complex issue. And I think you just cannot decide it on a yes/no, and I think you have to elect your politicians, and you have to you have to trust your politicians. And after all, the British system is a parliamentary system where Parliament is supreme, and in fact. Parliament.
Well, except when it has to comply with EU directives.
Well, it's
not supreme then, is it?
It's not supreme then, but that's a choice that Britain made, that on certain things it would be supreme. But basically, for instance, it will have to repeal the original act of going into the EU before Britain could actually Brexit. And in fact, I see some constitutional experts are now saying that actually you can't initiate the Article 50 without an act of Parliament. And if you don't have an act of Parliament and do it, there could be a judicial review. So I think there's a lot of mess around that we're going to see things be quite chaotic for a long, long time. But my final view is, I think in the end, Brexit won't happen.
Okay, thank you very much. That's George Corfoley, the former vice chair of the Hong Kong Democratic Foundation. We're going to break for 3 minutes for the news now, but we're going to be continuing discussion on Brexit and its wider effects around the world. Is it going to have some effect on globalisation, attitudes towards immigration generally? If you have any thoughts on this and other possible implications from the British referendum vote, do email us at backchat@rthk.hk. That's backchat@rthk.hk. Or you can go to our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio Free, and leave a comment there. The weather forecast for today is going to be hot with sunny intervals and a few showers. The maximum temperature will be around 32 degrees. It's currently 30 degrees. Relative humidity 79%. Back in 3 minutes. Welcome back to Backchat. I'm Danny Gittings. Your co-host this morning is Jim Gould. We're discussing the implications of the British referendum vote to leave the European Union. What kind of wider implications does it have in terms of the sentiment we saw about immigration in that vote and perhaps also for globalisation? Our guests, David Webb, shareholder activist and founder of website.com, Sean Stars, who's assistant professor at the Department of Asian and International Studies at City University of Hong Kong. We're also now joined by Dennis Edwards, who is a barrister and professional consultant at the Faculty of Law at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. If you have any thoughts, do email us at backchat@rthk.hk. That's backchat@rthk.hk. Or you go to our Facebook page, Backchat and RTHK Radio Free, and leave a comment there. Let me just bring in one more comment from a listener. Peter, responding in an email to something that David Webb had said earlier in the first half of the discussion. Peter says, the European Union doesn't just provide the UK with cheap strawberry pickers. There are many European Union citizens providing essential services in the National Health Service. Never mind the mythical £350 million, that was what the Brexiters had said would be saved by leaving the European Union. What will happen to the National Health Service in future? Thank you very much, Pete.
David Webb, you said a little earlier that...
do you want me to respond to that?
Oh, sure. Go ahead. All right, go ahead first.
Well, I mean, I think the point is that there is a debate to be had about how much labour any country imports and where from. And I think probably a uniform approach in a country like the UK, where it admits, for example, Filipino nurses just as easily as it would admit a Romanian nurse to work in an NHS hospital, if that's the decision, would be a fairer one than saying you must come from somewhere in the EU. It broadens their choice. But there will be an ongoing debate. They don't want to have every Somalian farmer, for example, working on the farms in the UK and depressing farm labour wages. There'll be a point at which any country wants to say it draws a line and would rather pay more for unskilled labour and have a more equitable society, even though that means consumers will have to pay more for their strawberries or whatever it else, or even for their other essential services.
You described the EU earlier as a failed experiment. I mean, thinking about the EU as a whole, would you expect further breakup if the United Kingdom does leave?
Well, there's certainly a lot of pressure from several countries along those lines. Not everyone voted in favour of every treaty along the way, and there was an attempt at a constitution, and then I think the Dutch and the French both voted by quite substantial majorities against signing that. And the European Union now needs to do some navel-gazing. They need to think about whether they should lighten up and produce a sort of EU light model that returns to the original principles of free trade, the aims of that, rather than seeking to standardise and legislate everything from the centre. Because would you... clear the message that's coming from a lot of voters, not just in the UK, is that that's gone too far and that they want more devolution of power, just like the Scots wanted and have obtained more devolution of power by trying to leave the UK. You know, they've now got a very viable Scottish Parliament and various powers have been transferred. I think also amongst the member states in the European Union, certainly the older ones, the longer members, they... are looking for a devolution of power. So the European Union, if it wants to stay together, needs to think about reshaping the agreement, the treaty, basically.
Would you like to see more countries leave the European Union, David Webb?
Well, I think it's a matter of more countries having more independence of decision-making, but still enjoying the benefits of free trade in goods and services and as much labour mobility as their populations can withstand.
Well, you're saying
and not putting a fortress Europe border around the whole thing as well, because, you know, that other countries manage to trade very freely with the world, New Zealand, Singapore, Switzerland, for example, without being members of the EU. The principles of free trade are laudable and allow more efficient allocation of capital and resources around the world. But the centralization of power is not something that most countries would aspire to. I don't think the United States would want to give up its independence and have a common decision-making body with Mexico and Canada, for example, but they're very happy to trade with each other.
Let's bring in Dennis Edwards, barrister, and good morning. And from the Faculty of Law of the Chinese University of Hong Kong, just on one legal point, for the United Kingdom to leave the European Union has to, as we mentioned earlier, has to invoke Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty. There seems to be some doubt as to whether that requires parliamentary approval. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that's a very complicated question of British constitutional law. Strictly, what happens is that the executive branch of the government, so for present purposes, David Cameron, on behalf of the Crown, will agree to treaties which bind the UK. But for a treaty to have effect in the domestic legal order of the United Kingdom, Parliament must give effect to the treaty, and essentially by passing an Act of Parliament incorporating the treaty into the domestic legal system. Now, that's what happened in 1972. The UK, at that time the Prime Minister was Edward Heath, the UK agreed to the treaty, what was then the Treaty of Rome, and after many debates in the UK Parliament, the Parliament passed the European Communities Act 1972. Now, the argument is that that Act and a considerable volume of legislation passed in accordance with it changes UK law so fundamentally and gives UK citizens legal rights that the what is understood as a prerogative power in relation to treaties is limited and compromised by the domestic law in the legislation, and that the government, the Crown's power to withdraw from the EU treaties is therefore limited by the domestic legislation. That's the essential constitutional problem, and some people say that Parliament has a right to be involved.
So as you said, Dennis Edwards, it's a fairly complicated issue of constitutional law there, but on a broader perspective, what do you make of the British referendum vote? A lot of people are saying that they're rather troubled by what it says about sentiments of certain sections of the British public and some of the racist graffiti we've seen after the vote and just the whole nature of the campaign. And do you share those concerns?
Well, I certainly
share the concerns that individual rights are affected and that some people, obviously extremists, have piggybacked on the referendum results to attack people verbally and in some cases worse than that. That's obviously appalling. And the UK government, to its credit, I think David Cameron yesterday in the House of Commons has said that that's quite unacceptable, and the criminal law will be used to pursue and punish people who do that. The UK is a very diverse society, and it's a very, I think it's one of the most successful multicultural societies in the world. And the fact, well, whether or not Britain is in the EU or out of the EU shouldn't affect that. The UK has always been a tolerant country, and this shouldn't really have any implications for that.
You sound quite ambivalent then about whether Britain's in the European Union or not.
I don't think Britain's membership of the EU is relevant to its success as a multicultural society. I think that Britain's success as a multicultural society and its well-developed system of equality laws, which have certainly been enhanced and strengthened by EU law, Britain's traditions shouldn't depend on whether or not it's a member of the EU or not. That's putting the cart before the horse. My own personal view is that I regret the decision in the referendum, but of course we must respect it. The UK, one of those traditions that I'm thinking about when I talk about the UK, is democracy.
Earlier on, before you joined us, we had several listeners commenting, saying that this referendum result really showed that referendums are not a very good way of deciding these kind of important issues. So, do you have any sympathy with that view?
I'm speaking as a lawyer, obviously. I'm not a politician. As a lawyer, of course, the Constitution enables Parliament in the UK to say how issues are to be decided. Referendums are rare in the UK, but they've tended to be used for big constitutional questions. I mean, this is only the third referendum, national referendum in the UK, the first one in 1975 about whether or not the UK would stay in the EU, then the referendum on the voting system, and then this third referendum. There's also been referendums in Scotland on devolution and independence, of course, more recently. But in terms of the UK nationally, there's only been three. And the reasons for them politically are, in the case of the voting referendum a few years ago, well, that was one of the conditions of the coalition agreement, so there was a clear political reason for that. And the two other referendums that there's been in 1975 and now a few last week on the EU are explained because of internal divisions in the governing party in 1975, the Labour Party, and now the Conservative Party. So there are political reasons for them, and Parliament passes the law to enable them to take place. Now, whether or not they're a good idea, my own personal view is that they are not good ways to settle fundamental constitutional questions.
Surely,
for the simple reason you don't know why people are voting.
Surely, going back to the constitutional question, isn't it implicit in Parliament's decision to allow a referendum on this issue that it believes that it is leaving the decision in the hands of the people, and it won't get a second bite at the cherry by trying to undo their decision and not repeal some 1975 act, and also the fact that the treaty now includes an exit clause, Article 50, which is implicitly endorsed by Parliament in allowing that treaty to have been amended.
Well, Article 50 of the treaty specifically says that in its first paragraph that it's up to the member states to decide whether to withdraw from the EU in accordance with their own constitutional arrangements.
Right.
So the question that begs is what the UK's internal constitutional arrangements are for withdrawing from the EU.
Politically, wouldn't there be a lot of uproar if the people felt they'd been misled and didn't, in fact, have the choice that they were given in that referendum last week, and instead that they were subsequently told that it was just a sort of how do you feel about things, but we're going to decide in Parliament?
Well, I mean, there's two answers to that. The first is, of course, that the UK is a system governed by the rule of law, and so it's absolutely essential that the law is observed, and the debate that's going on that I started with about what the law is that governs the withdrawal from the EU treaties is complicated, and it may ultimately have to be determined by the UK courts. But the other way to look at it is, as you say, that there has been this solemn referendum after 4 months of debate, and And I think those who are saying that they can be ignored in any way or annulled or overlooked are they're playing with fire. I agree with you to that extent.
Okay, let's bring in some more comments from our listeners. We're discussing the implications of the British referendum vote. Peter says in a brief email, Jean-Claude Juncker seems to think that a new British Prime Minister could trigger Article 50 within one day if it's Boris. Does he not understand British parliamentary procedure? And in a long email, Bowen says, Dear Backchat, the fact that we have localist movements in Britain, Quebec, Spain, Scotland, the United States and Hong Kong all at the same time is arguably and ironically testament to the power of globalization. In the discussion on Backchat last Friday, a parallel was drawn by your co-host between the Leave and Remain campaigns in Brexit and the Yellow and Blue Ribbon groups in Hong Kong during the Umbrella Movement. While the debate between the Leave and Remain campaigns was and is a genuine one, stemming from real differences between people who bring original and independent thinking to the issue, the debate between the Yellow and Blue Ribbon camps in Hong Kong in 2014 was not equally balanced in that respect. While we witnessed extensive debate on options for constitutional reform and various propositions emerging from the pan-democratic camp, and indeed also some of the more conservative more serious conservative groups, such as academics like Professor Sung Yun Wing, the so-called Blue Ribbon Camp was by and large mainly engaged in Cultural Revolution-style propaganda and tactics without much original and independent thought and analysis. What Hong Kong needs and deserves is an intelligent discussion based on a thoughtful analysis of cumulative thinking and experiments which have been carried out in the world for several centuries on governance and different systems of government. What we often do not get among certain groups in Hong Kong. Thank you very much, Bowen. If you've got any thoughts on this and related issues, do email us at backchat@rthk.hk. You can go to our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio 3, or indeed you can call us. The number there, 233-88266. That's 233-88266. Us, Mike has done. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
May I just say first,
and that is, I really appreciate the way you enunciate, and when you're reading the emails, we can really understand what's being said. There are other commentators
who
swallow their words. Okay, now, my point is, how do the British think about Obama and his comments? We heard him at 9 o'clock. I mean, are they pretty offended to have somebody from across the pond giving them suggestions on what they might do or might not do?
Do you think Obama was out of line, do you then?
Well, I was asking someone that was, I think he's always out of line, but I was just wondering. I was wondering what, you know,
And what do you think about Donald Trump then? Is he out of line? if Obama is always out of line, then you're obviously a Republican. What do you think about your candidate?
Well, you know what? I'm neither because, but I think that the Donald Trump is telling Americans what they can or shouldn't do or what we should do in the world situation, where Obama is coming over to Britain and telling the British, you know,
get to the back of the queue. Yeah.
David Cameron invited him over though to help support his Remain campaign in April.
But my point being is that I would feel offended if Hillary or somebody invited a leader from another country to come over to America and tell us what we should do. You should love and embrace all the illegal immigrants coming into your country because they've added so much to it.
One of the interesting consequences of Brexit when they leave is that they will all of the treaties that the free trade agreements that the EU has reached with other countries outside the EU will fall away, and Britain currently lacks the apparatus because it kind of devolved it all to the EU or hived it up to the EU to negotiate those arrangements. So I think the starting point has to be, like Hong Kong, no duties on any imports except for the alcohol and tobacco issue.
And
that would be a very pro-trade position, a stance for the UK to adopt.
I've got friends that have factories that did most of their business before this all started, most of their business in the UK, and they're very successful. And you know, they said, you know, doing business in the EU, it's been miserable, and so, you know, they're just closing factories down.
Mike, what do you think of the comparisons that are drawn between people who voted for Brexit and the support for Donald Trump, and people saying it's part of the same sort of sentiment? Would you share that sort of view?
No, I don't. I really think Donald Trump is just Donald Trump's. The people that are voting for Donald Trump are just, it's a protest vote. You know, it's anti-establishment. We've seen what the establishment has done in, for the last 40 years, and they're getting panicked. You know, if you look and see what's going on, and you listen to who's really doing all the complaining, it's the establishment, and they are they're worried.
And as an American, would you draw any wider implications from the British referendum results, stretching beyond Britain and the European Union, perhaps to the U.S. or this part of the world?
Well, not really, because I'm a firm believer that that the clay and iron will never mix. And the feet of the image of clay and iron, you go to your Bible, you know, the Babylon was the head of gold, and then the silver and the bronze. And when it got down to the feet and iron, how many people have tried to unite Europe over the last 100 years?
Okay. Thank you.
And it never worked.
Napoleon, for example. Go back a bit further.
There you go.
Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you for joining us. That was Caller Mike. Let me bring in a few more comments from listeners, and we'll go back to our guest. Another short email on our Facebook post. There's another short post on our Facebook page. Henry says, each country has a different background, and thus it's not easy to see if a wave of localism will ensue from the British referendum result. Exiting the European Union or other similar institutions means opening the Pandora box for exiting the country with serious unpredictable outcomes. For Hong Kong, opposition forces would probably think twice prior to talking about referendum, now that referendum is almost bankrupt following Brexit. Good governance depends not only on referendum, but also on quality representative democracy. In a short email, Peter says quite simply, Brexit, the reason for not deciding the referendum on a simple majority. And in another email, John says, democracy is something extremely difficult to manage. Europe definitely has some problems. A big one was not to have a constitution. But it's unthinkable to allow the population of a country to decide to stay or to exit. We do elect politicians. That supposedly should be good enough to make important decisions. If your idea of democracy is this, so we should all vote about NATO, the euro, immigration, investment, and so on. No, Mr. Webb, that's obviously a reference to David Webb, this referendum was not about democracy, it was stupidity. Thank you very much, John. David Webb, I'm sure you want to respond.
Well, yeah, I think that there's a lot of stupidity when people vote, but it's the least bad system, except, you know, compared to all the others, as Churchill once said. I mean, if you don't like what your politicians vote for once they become MPs, then you can replace them. And every time you have an election, as they're about to have for the President of the United States, there will be a lot of people casting their votes for very personal and sentimental reasons. But at the end of the day, you have a democratic process and a system for correcting bad decisions. And if you start shifting away from the 50% majority vote in a referendum or in an election between two parties, then you're getting to the point where you're saying, well, there's an incumbent advantage. There's a status quo advantage. You need 75% before you leave the EU, but you only need 50% to join it, or you need 75% to join it in the first place. There's an elegance about 50%. It's the measure by which we elect our representatives in the first place.
Okay, we've only got a few minutes left. Let me bring one more comment from a listener, and then perhaps David Webby could briefly respond, and we'll go to other guests. John says, it's been reported that leaving the European Union also means loss of a seat at the World Trade Organization and other trade organizations, something not mentioned by the Leave campaign. What other consequences will follow? Thank you, John. David Webby, your comments briefly.
Certainly it doesn't. The UK remains a member of the WTO and is no longer bound by the decision of the EU once it leaves.
Okay, Sean Stars. How about Bowen's earlier point about we've seen the rise of localist movements in various parts of the world? To what extent is that a kickback against globalization?
I think they're against a certain kind of globalization. So young people are not against the fact that they can buy sushi in the supermarket or they can Skype their friends from halfway across the world. They're against a certain kind of globalization, which they perceive that political and economic elites drive it for their own benefit. And so they want to see a more human globalization. But in the case of Britain, I'm still not convinced that a majority of people actually want to leave. I think a lot of people are in denial. So two-thirds voted not to leave. And I don't think the debate is over. I think a lot of people are talking about the possibility of a second referendum. There's no legal reason why that can't happen. I think even Angela Merkel is, leaving out that possibility by dragging her feet.
The phrase "sore losers" springs to mind. I mean, how many you just keep voting until you get
the right
result? A lot
of people are in denial. And they didn't realize
didn't
the consequences of Brexit.
It's a fairly simple question on the voting paper.
Well, Dennis Edwards, there's no legal reason not to hold another referendum, is there?
You can have as many as you want, of course, until you get the answer you want. The reality is, though, I think that as I said when I was speaking, there have only been three referendums in the UK in the last 40 years nationally. Two of them have been on the EU. I think here law and politics have to be distinguished. You're right, there's no legal reason why you can't have another referendum next year, although, of course, it will take a year. I mean, it takes the best part of a year to get all the mechanics in place and to have a campaign and so on. So I think politically it's unrealistic that this time next year you can have another referendum on the same question.
I think Boris Johnson was shocked at the result, So, I mean, he's backtracked on some of his...
Yeah, I think we've all been shocked at the result. I mean, I think the more likely outcome is there will be some sort of negotiation on leading to an association agreement of some sort. I don't know what the model of that is going to be, but the reality is that even that will be politically divisive, and that will either have to go to a general election or possibly another referendum. But I don't think it's feasible to have another referendum on the same question within a year or two. I think it has to be a little further away than that, and on a slightly different question, although the upshot may, I suppose, be the same.
David Webb, what would you like to see come out of this referendum result?
Well, I think the UK has to move forward now with an open trade policy, which is something that Boris Johnson has advocated in his remarks immediately after the Brexit vote. It is a friend. The UK is a friend to Europe and a friend to the world, and needs to quickly move forward and negotiate the best deal it can get from the EU, bearing in mind that several other countries in the EU would like to achieve the same deal, and that may lead to a reshaping of the EU into something more acceptable to the members, to the populations of the member states, and something more sustainable as a free trade area.
Okay, Sean Stiles, your closing thoughts?
We're going to go through a prolonged period of uncertainty. I don't think the debate is over.
Okay, thank you very much to our panel. And our panel in this part of discussion was David Webb, shareholder activist and founder of website.com. You just heard Sean Stiles, assistant professor at Department of Asian and International Studies at the City University of Hong Kong. Dennis Edwards, barrister and professional consultant at the Faculty of Law, Chinese University of Hong Kong. I'll leave the last comment to one of our listeners, Peter, in a follow-up email explaining a bit more on his earlier very short email. Peter says, the reason for not deciding European Union and Scottish referendums on a simple majority is that these are major constitutional issues. It makes sense that overwhelming support should be shown for such changes to be effected. The referendum was not asked for by the British people, but was instigated by Cameron to deal with dissent in his own party. What we now have is deep divisions in the country, regret by many who voted out, and whole countries, Scotland and Northern Ireland, whose wishes have been ignored. Thank you very much, Peter. Thank you to all our listeners who emailed or sent in comments on Facebook. Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, very thought-provoking debate this morning.
It was indeed.